day. This is Midday, and I'm Arun Vanagopal. Earlier this month, thousands of New Yorkers decided where to attend undergrad or grad school in the fall. And as most of us know, after the big excitement of this decision comes the dreaded question of how to pay for it. We're talking about this in a series called The Costs of Higher Ed. Last week, we discussed why tuition is increasing, and this week, we're looking at the campus jobs students do to afford their degrees. We're joined by Rebecca Given, a labor studies professor at Rutgers University, and on the phone, we have Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher ed for The Washington Post. Rebecca, Danielle, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, have you ever participated in federal work study or another job for your university, like maybe being a TA? Was it really worth it? Give us a call at 212-433-9692. Again, that's 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet at us. We're at WNYC Midday, or just leave a comment on our show page. So, Rebecca and Danielle, Rebecca, why don't we go with you? Remind us first, we talked last week about why tuition has increased, but give us a general sense of how much tuition has actually gone up in the last 10 years, if you could.
Tuition has gone up at far higher than the rate of inflation, primarily in public universities because that public subsidy from general taxpayers' money has gone way down, and most public universities are primarily getting by on tuition. Private universities have it a little bit differently because some of them, the wealthier ones, have quite large endowments. So they, the top tier don't even need to charge tuition at all, they could do everything they need from their endowment income. Then we have the significant set of institutions below that who are completely tuition dependent and can't do anything without tuition. And costs are going up. Every kind of cost is going up, and public support is going down, and that means tuition goes up.
So, Danielle, can you give us any examples, dramatic examples of a particular institution where the costs have just gone up like crazy?
Well, I can think of maybe one of your local institutions, which is a private institution, New York University, where costs have gone up pretty significantly in terms of tuition. Right now, NYU's tuition is a little over $50,000 a year, whereas maybe a decade ago it was around $20,000 or $30,000. Certainly, NYU has a far more substantial endowment than many other private institutions, and certainly many public regional institutions. Yet the school says that it needs tuition dollars just as much as any other school in order to keep its operations going. So as a result, they have had to increase tuition appropriately in order to continue to provide the education that they are known for.
So Danielle, let's talk about federal student aid, the kind of thing that students use to pay for school. What programs actually fall under this term, federal student aid?
So federal student aid is everything from Pell Grants to federal student loans to federal work study. And these programs taken together can help low-income students as well as middle-income students afford the cost of college. Now, federal work study is one of those programs where it kind of fits the ideals of students should have some skin in the game for their education, meaning that they should participate in some work towards paying for it. It's just that the program has its faults, and there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle calling for greater reforms to the way it operates.
So tell us what a Pell Grant is.
So a Pell Grant essentially is determined by what your family contribution would be. So generally it goes to folks whose families earn less than $60,000 a year, though it depends on where you're going to school, how that calculation bears out. But this is money that doesn't have to be repaid, whereas a federal grant does have to be repaid. So the maximum Pell Grant award, I think right now, is a little over $5,500 per semester or for the year, and that gradually goes up depending on what year you are as an undergraduate.
So $5,500 means it's essentially limiting the kind of institutions you can really be applying to, or at least accepting from.
Certainly, the purchasing power of Pell is not what it used to be. Back in the 70s and 80s, you could attend most public research universities and as a low-income student and have the majority of that cost covered by Pell and other state grants. That's not really the case anymore.
So has the availability of federal student aid actually gone down in real terms, or just gone up much slower than the actual cost of schools?
The latter. It's gone up a lot slower than the actual cost of schools. So the purchasing power, again, makes a big difference, especially when you're talking about where you want to go to school, private versus public, regional versus flagship, community college versus all the other sorts of schools that exist.
So when we do talk about student aid, is most of that coming in the form of federal loans that the student has to eventually repay?
These days, it certainly is. About a week or two ago, we passed the $1.5 trillion mark in federal student debt, which kind of gives you a sense of where we are in terms of people needing to borrow. And this is federal and private loans in order to cover the cost of college.
Well, so what does that come down to for an individual student once they've graduated from undergrad or grad school? How much debt are they carrying per capita?
It very much depends. There are, if you're talking undergraduate or graduate, for a lot of undergraduate students, the average debt is actually around $10,000. But when you start to factor in more expensive schools, you see that debt load go up. And then when you start to factor in graduate degrees, be it professional or doctoral programs, then the debt load certainly goes up. I mean, for someone who's attending law school or medical school, we're talking six figures here in terms of debt load on average. But for someone graduating from, say, a public university, that could be a lot less. The big problem is the idea of people taking on debt and not graduating. So if that happens, you're less likely to be able to afford or get a job that can help you pay back that debt. And that's when you start seeing people fall delinquent and start defaulting on those loans.
Mm-hmm. And Rebecca, are a lot of grad students entering grad school with high levels of debt?
Yeah, graduate students are both entering with high levels of debt and taking on more debt. So the latest numbers we have tell us that graduate students have on average over $77,000 worth of loans. And although we may leap to thinking about some of the professional degrees like MBAs and law degrees that may lead to higher paying jobs, we have to remember that many graduate students are going to become social workers, they're going to become college professors, they're going to enter careers that might not be particularly well paying, and they're getting into very, very high levels of debt, mostly through unsubsidized loans.
So is there anyone or any sort of system that counsels people, suggests whether it's a realistic amount of debt, or is that very much just an individual, like if you happen to have family who really know the economics or the math of this, that they're telling you this? Is it all very unstructured?
It's fairly unstructured. Some graduate programs will publicize the starting salaries for their graduates, so you may be able to get some information, but it is almost impossible to enter many of these careers without a graduate degree. So you have to factor that into your decision as well. If you feel drawn to a particular career or have a gift or a talent for it, and you don't come from any particular family money or a cushion or have someone, a partner or parents who can help you with the cost of school, you have a choice of choosing a different career entirely or taking on this high level of debt.
Listeners, have you participated in federal work study or any other sort of job for your university, like maybe being a TA? Please give us a call at 212-433-9692. Danielle, what are some examples of a campus job you might get that is part of any of these programs?
Sure. So federal work study campus jobs can be anything from working in the local library, working at the rec center. There are some schools that have partnerships with outside companies in order to do federal work study programs. And it can pay anywhere from like $10 to $15, depending on what school you're at and where you are in the country. So there is some variety. The thing that's lacking in federal work study, at least that's the opinion of a lot of folks in higher education, is a lot of these jobs have nothing to do with the field of study that students are going into, and so the value of that work becomes kind of questionable. Certainly the money is useful, as students need money to pay for books and cover living expenses and the like, but the actual value of the work that they're doing is kind kind of questionable.
And how does a student qualify for work study?
It depends on your expected family contribution. If you are at a really expensive school, then it could look like, even if you're a middle-income student, that you would qualify for federal work study. And that kind of is another one of the problems with the way the program is right now. The existing formula tends to benefit a lot of schools that have been in the program longer, which happen to be big public flagships and well-off private universities. So a lot of middle-income students get to benefit, while lower-income students who could probably use the money of that a little bit more aren't really getting that money because community colleges aren't getting a great share of the dollars and other institutions that tend to serve a large majority of low-income students.
I'm talking to Rebecca Given, Labor Studies Professor at Rutgers, and Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher ed for The Washington Post. We're talking about the kinds of campus jobs students do to afford their undergrad or graduate degrees. Let's talk again about these minimum wage, or I guess you said they're $10 to $15 an hour jobs. At this rate, is it really worth it when your school is charging $45,000 to $65,000 a year?
I mean, if you are a low-income student who is having a hard time finding a job elsewhere, this can be a lifeline. So any bit of money does become worth it. As someone who actually participated in federal work study in undergrad, I can tell you that that job was a savior for me. And I imagine it could be the same for lots of students who are similarly economically situated.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering if the value, as it's sort of understood traditionally, if that's changing as the disparity between how much you're making and how much this degree costs you, if that is being affected when $10 or $15 an hour is nothing to sneeze at, but when you're trying to actually make up for this potentially vast amount of money, is it becoming harder and harder to justify that?
I mean, it is. I don't know if it's necessarily hard to justify it, because you have to keep in mind that a lot of students who qualify for federal work study are on other forms of federal student aid.
Okay.
But it certainly is. It is not as helpful as it possibly could be, given the cost of education. But that doesn't mean that it's not still a useful program. There are a lot of efforts underway to reform the way federal work study works in terms of the formula for allocating dollars, as well as ensuring that students are participating in jobs that can help their career prospects. So looking at those reforms is a smart way to start really thinking about how to make this program work for a larger number of students.
All right, we've got a caller, Ivan, calling from Long Island. Hi, how are you?
Hi. I just wanted to briefly relate the experience of my son, who is in grad school in the Midwest at a university. He is an assistant. He has an assistantship to teach and study. He just finished his master's degree, and he's going to stay on for his PhD. However, the problem is that the stipend that the university gives him barely covers his basic expenses. He doesn't have money for books or for food, so I have to provide that. And basically, the university is exploiting this graduate assistance, because they're saving the money that they would pay a full professor. You know, they're saving. He's getting a stipend, and he's getting tuition remission for at most 10 graduate credits every semester. So basically, they're taking advantage of these young students because they can. And it happens to be a right-to-work state.
Well, thank you, Ivan. Why don't you stay on the phone there while we try to figure this out? So, Rebecca, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I think actually Ivan's account of his son's situation really encapsulates a lot of what's going on with graduate student labor right now. So Ivan mentioned doing the same work as a professor might do or might have done for lower wages. That's something that we see a lot. You tend to get a tuition waiver, which is worth a certain amount, but as the caller mentioned, has limits on it. And not enough money in that income from the assistantship to actually cover the cost of living. So we know that The typical graduate assistantship pays somewhere in the region of $29,000 to $35,000 a year, but for some universities, it's much lower than that. And in many places, not just New York City, that's simply not enough to cover the cost of living for a single person household, let alone if you are trying to support other family members. So we see all of these pieces with universities trying to use more lower cost graduate assistant labor rather than full faculty labor to do the teaching and research of the university, and not paying those student workers enough to really cover their cost of living.
Ivan, are you still there?
Yes.
Can you share with me how much you're shelling out on each semester because these
I believe that it is rampant exploitation because he's getting around $10,000 per academic year, and the rest, his rent, his food, his book expenses, I am covering, which I'm happy to do because we have no other choice. But it's postponing, you know, my own personal life, retirement and all that. But, you know, we put our arms, our elbow to work, and he will eventually graduate, even though, you know, this exploitation could be exposed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you.
And for many people that... Ivan is providing family support, and for others that would be those unsubsidized loans, right? So graduating with a degree, which in the case of a doctorate doesn't lead to particularly high-paying professional opportunities, but with a very high level of debt because of basically providing low-cost labor to the university, which it's essentially selling to these undergrads that are paying higher and higher tuition, as Danielle mentioned.
Ivan, thank you for your call. After the break, we're going to speak to some more listeners about their experiences with work study and graduate student labor. Okay. All right, we're talking about college and how to afford it, campus jobs that students can do to afford their degrees. And let's take another call from Lori in Jamaica. Work study was a game changer for your kids. Is that right?
Yes, especially for my older daughter who attended Cornell, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, which is the public part of Cornell, which still in 10 years ago still cost close to $40,000 a year. And in her junior and senior year, she became she started out with work study working in a dining hall. And then in her junior and senior year, she became the one of the student directors of a dining hall. And so she didn't have to have a food plan anymore, and she could eat there free. And that probably saved, over the 2 years that she did that, $12,000.
That's significant. That's significant, isn't it?
Yes. And it meant that she didn't have to have $12,000 more in loans that she would have had to take out.
And again, when did she get her degree?
Let's see. She's 29, so she graduated seven years ago. And then she went to graduate school a few years after that. So I want to speak to what that gentleman said earlier. She came, even though she was a graduate assistant, she ended up having to take out about almost $30,000 in additional loans just to be able to live for 2 years. So yeah, it's not an equal. You're not really paid a living wage. When you're a graduate assistant.
So let's
and
turn this
teaching classes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lori. So let's turn this over to our guest. We are joined again by Rebecca Given, a labor studies professor at Rutgers, and Danielle Douglas Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher ed for the Washington Post. Danielle, does this sound familiar to you?
Oh, very. Both the federal work study advantage for some folks, as well as the graduate student, graduate worker problem. And I just wanted to mention that graduate student loans, federal loans, are actually at a higher interest rate than undergraduate ones. So we're talking at times, at least these days, at least 6% or more in interest that graduate students have to pay, plus origination fees. So they're very expensive loans. So this isn't a small investment that we're asking graduate students to make towards completing a degree. I think one of the reasons why you are starting to see this wave of graduate student union movements in the private sector, in the private university space in particular, is because the conditions are not sustainable. Even at a place like Columbia, which has been fighting its graduate students tooth and nail to put down the union there, you know, the annual stipends at, in some schools can be like $28,000. And Columbia, like many schools, will say, well, hey, we're making this investment of covering your tuition plus paying you a stipend and other benefits of over $80,000. That was what I think one of the provosts said last time this issue came up. But for someone who's living in an expensive city like New York, you're not feeling that. What you're feeling is you have to cover your rent, you have to pay for food, you have to pay for travel, and you can't find the time to have multiple jobs while trying to pursue a degree and teach these classes. So it's just not a situation that can continue to exist at many schools, whether they're on the East Coast in more expensive cities or elsewhere.
Let's take another call. Lisa in Connecticut, you went to NYU and you were a one-time TA.
Yes. Back in 1988, I was there for my master's degree and I was a TA and I did get Pell Grants and loans and I was able to kind of cobble together enough to pretty much pay for everything. I did find being a TA convenient because, you know, with tuition remission, which was commensurate with whatever the, you know, going fees were. But also, I could easily schedule it around my classes. You know, I didn't have to go to a separate place to work. So fast forward now, almost 30 years later, I am an associate professor in a graduate program, and I hire the TAs. We do the same thing. We offer tuition remission. You know, for that, we don't ask them to teach or perform any of our duties. It's all supplemental things, you know, helping us organize, prepare for class, things like that. No grading, nothing like that. But I wanted to just also add to this mix, having been on both sides, having been teaching since 2003 on the graduate level and watching tuition increase. I think my tuition for those 2 years at NYU at the time, 1988, were around $20,000. So it's now increased, what, over 100%. I am currently making, as a not only an associate professor, but the director of a graduate program, less money than someone who teaches elementary school in the town, suburban town where I live. So what I've seen happen is tuition has increased exponentially since the 1970s, but college professors' pay scales have not. So I'm wondering sort of where all this money is going, because I'm struggling living as a single person with all of this experience, you know, on associate professor salary. And I don't understand that piece either.
Rebecca Given, labor studies professor at Rutgers. Do you want to handle that question?
Sure. I mean, I can say a few things about that. We already mentioned that tuition has obviously gone up much, much more quickly than inflation. And the money is going to all kinds of things that you probably see around campus that you may or may not think are the top priorities. So everything from nicer dorms to attract those tuition paying undergraduate students to large numbers of administrators, the number of people working sort of administrative jobs, whether those are more support positions or whether those are high level management type positions, has massively boomed in universities. And you see it all around campus, all the new different kinds of expenses. So every once in a while, there'll be an article that gets a lot of attention about the new gimmick that students are spending, that universities are spending money on to attract undergraduates. So whether it's having a lazy river so hot students in a sunny part of the country can relax more thoroughly or whatever it is. But more money is being spent on more things. And the public subsidy, the state funding towards higher education has gone way, way down. And so that money has to come from somewhere.
And I'm curious, Rebecca, the difference between being a research assistant and a teaching assistant, is that a significant difference in terms of how much time you're putting in?
It really depends. In both cases, your boss essentially will usually be a faculty member, and so a lot is at the discretion of that boss. So for a research assistant, that's a pretty broad category where you may be working in a lab. It may look a lot like a 9-to-5 job or a regular job, but with much longer hours than 9-to-5. And as a teaching assistant, your duties vary. It sounds like where the caller is working, the duties are quite carefully defined. But at other places, you may be called a TA, but you may be teaching your own class, and you may be fielding student questions, emails, meetings at all times of the sort of day, night, weekdays, weekends, and working a huge number of hours. So those broad categories don't tell you that much about how much time the worker might be putting into that particular job.
And is there reason to believe that because of the costs, the high cost of attending grad school, that universities are losing out on a lot of great talent that they might have otherwise secured 20 or 30 years ago?
I mean, there's always the opportunity cost of attending grad school versus just entering the workforce and doing something that is going to pay better and pay better immediately and not require that level of indebtedness. So we certainly see a problem with what we faculty consider a pipeline, new faculty entering the profession, where the financial situation is quite a deterrent to people who don't come from situations where they have a sort of cushion, whether it's family resources or lower levels of undergraduate loans so that they're more comfortable taking on loans for their graduate degree or whatever it is. So we do see the lower income people are less likely to enter academic careers because of the high cost and the high level of debt that's generally required.
Listeners, we want to hear about your campus job and whether you think it was worth it. Please give us a call at 212-433-9692. We do have some people comments coming in through Twitter. Sarah from Maryland wrote to us saying, "In my department, students who are very talented TAs were asked to TA for many semesters without additional compensation, while other students were funded with the same stipend on research assistantships to do their graduate research without the sizable time commitment of TAing." Rebecca, go ahead. Just what was the distinction there we should know?
Yeah, I think one of the things we're getting at there is the degree of discretion that supervisors have over their graduate students who are also their graduate workers, right? So the ability to allocate people to teach classes that may or may not be in their area of focus and to assist with research that may or may not be in their area of focus. And one of the issues that's come up again and again with graduate student unionizing is the ability to have a grievance procedure and to bring up something like that seems arbitrary, that seems unfair, that seems based on some kind of favoritism or discrimination, where some students are actually having better opportunities to get experience and complete their degrees in a timely manner and others aren't. And without some kind of grievance procedure, it's very difficult to do anything about these inequities.
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, you covered the economics of higher ed for the Washington Post. In March, there were a bunch of congressional proposals to change how higher ed was funded. Tell us a little about these and how they would affect the student aid landscape.
So there is one major bill right now that is in the House called the Prosper Act that would be would reauthorize the Higher Education Act that essentially governs much of all the policy in higher education. Part of that is changing how federal student aid is doled out, what kinds of programs are accessible to graduate students versus undergrad. Like, for instance, the House GOP would like to cut graduate students out of federal work study altogether. They don't represent a particularly large number of people who take advantage of the program, but it is one of the many tools that they could still access if they are in need of a little federal assistance to pay for school. The other things that it would change is the current public service loan forgiveness program. Now, for many people who do have to pursue professional degrees, like teachers and social workers, the U.S. government has a program that says that if you were to pay on time for 10 years towards your federal student loans, then after those 10 years, the balance that's left over would be forgiven. There's been a lot of talk about getting rid of the program or limiting its access, and this bill would make some significant changes, which would work to the detriment of a lot of people who may want to participate in that program in the long run. So that's just two of the things. It's a pretty meaty and hefty bill. Right now it is passed committee, but hasn't really gone anywhere, and we're not certain whether or not it'll make much headway this year because there isn't much agreement on the direction that we should be going with a federal student aid.
Given that the Republican Party controls both chambers, is there much heat? I mean, are their constituents really delivering a lot of protests to them about access and the affordability of university experience education?
Not in the way that you would think. I think where we saw a lot of protests came around the tax plan, in part because there was a proposal to tax graduate tuition waivers that many teaching and research assistants rely on in order to pursue graduate education. And we saw that movement effectively squash that proposal. So I imagine if the PROSPER Act were to advance any further, that you could see folks start to mobilize around issues of federal student aid, around graduate work, and around other issues that are covered within the PROSPER Act. But at this point, we're just not there yet.
Now, the schools that reap the most work-study benefits tend to be the elite four-year colleges, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
You know, it's just the way that the formula works, in part because a lot of these schools have been in the program for longer, so they get a larger share of the money. Schools like NYU, schools like public research universities also tend to get a large share of it because they've been participants for a much longer time. There are some bills in play right now to change that formula, and instead of having it rely so much on your historical participation, it would be what percentage of your student body is Pell Grant eligible, which again is that kind of marker to say that you are lower income. And as a result, what that would mean is that more federal work study dollars would go to schools that have higher percentages of low income students, ensuring that they're the ones who get to participate and benefit the most from the program.
All right, let's take another caller. We're going to go to Tanya in Westchester, who has a positive experience related to graduate student labor. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. My son is a PhD math candidate at the University of Chicago, and he's living on $26,000 a year, takes out no loans. It is a financial sacrifice, but he also sees it as he's getting this enormous benefit of this incredibly valuable education, and it's an investment into his future, and it's a very calculated choice he's made about his own path and future. He could have gone into the private sector and earned $100,000 off the bat, but he chose not to do that because it's a different path.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, and I think, you know, a lot of people entering graduate school are choosing going in with their eyes open and knowing what their income as a graduate assistant might be. But I want to say that one of the fights around graduate student labor and graduate student union organizing rights and trying to be recognized for collective bargaining, it's not just about pay. It's also about things like protection against sexual harassment. It's about, in some cases, access to workers' comp, where people who are injured on the job in their job as a graduate assistant in some states have been and in some universities have been defined outside of the workers' comp system. So we get people doing very dangerous work in labs, working with chemicals, and they don't have access to workers' comp when they get injured. In the era of Me Too, we're seeing the importance of having appropriate procedures for people who have experienced sexual harassment, other forms of sexual misconduct. So there are a number of ways. It's not just the salary, that being recognized as employees and being able to collectively bargain for their rights can really, really make a huge difference.
So, if I understand right, some universities are framing being a TA as an educational experience, right?
Well, they are trying to define the graduate assistants as essentially students who are doing a few things here and there that are only enhancing their education but aren't contributing anything to the university, and they're in fact a cost to the university. So the notion sometimes becomes absurd that somehow a graduate employee grading undergraduate papers is not contributing anything to that undergraduate's education. It becomes a little bit absurd.
Tanya, was that helpful? All right, we lost Tanya here. I'm curious, Rebecca, when it comes to undergraduate experiences, whereas in the graduate school, most of these people are doing work that is somehow related to their work. That's not often the case when it comes to undergraduate work study or anything, is it?
That's right. I mean, in most cases, as an undergrad work study worker, you'll take whatever job is available. In some cases, there might be some research-related work, some work related to your major that you might be able to do, but that's usually not guaranteed. And for many students, as the other guest mentioned, it would be the dining hall or checking people in at the campus rec center or something like that, which is less likely to be related to your major, although it may be.
And Danielle, we've got a question related to a previous bit of this conversation. The new tax law, does that mean that we don't have the same tuition credits as before? This is some listeners are asking that question in terms of deductions for education costs.
Much of that was actually stricken out of the bill. So the issues in terms of interest rate deductions on student loans and all of those things were squashed at the end. So that was pretty beneficial. It hasn't been as detrimental as people were initially thinking that it was going to be, and I think a lot of that is because of the activity of graduate student union workers as well as protesters who were calling congressmen on 24 hours a day saying, please don't make it more difficult for us to get an education.
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel of the Washington Post and Rebecca Given, Labor Studies Professor at Rutgers, thank you both for joining us in this conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you.